My name is Dario Hasenstab. I'm here with Walter Hagratz, and we're back with the Western Bubble podcast. Today, we're talking about the United States Supreme Court. Hi, Walter. Why are we talking about this topic today? Why are we talking about the United States Supreme Court?
Hi, Dario. Well, the Supreme Court has issued a number of verdicts at the end of the term. They're going to go for a summer recess now. And those verdicts have huge implications for the way that United States political system operates. But more than anything, we are seeing the United States political system kind of crash in front of our eyes. A political system that for the past 250 years has claimed to be the epitome of political progress and an example for the rest of the world to follow is rapidly decaying and falling apart. And that has enormous consequences, not just for the United States, but also for the rest of the world.
And what are the facts?
The United States Supreme Court was established in Article 3 of the U.S. Constitution. There have traditionally been 9 justices appointed by the sitting president and approved by the U.S. Senate. Traditionally, the court has enjoyed high approval ratings. However, ratings have dropped from the high 60s in the late 1980s to around 40% in the early 2020s. One major reason for this is the increased politicization of the US Supreme Court in past years. The court has also been rocked with ethical scandals in the past few years. Some revolve around politics, such as the failed nomination of Merrick Garland to the court in 2016, compared to the speedy appointment of Justice Coney Barrett in 2020, while some deal more with corruption, like the expensive gifts that Justice Clarence Thomas has received and failed to report in his 30-year tenure on the court. Questions of ethics and politicization came to a head on July 1st when the court ruled that President Trump enjoys immunity for crimes committed while in office.
What is the bubble?
So, for transparency, we are recording this episode on July 1st. So, the decision by the US Supreme Court is about 6 hours old. And also for transparency, and no surprise to regular listeners, we are not lawyers. We are not experts on constitutional law in the United States, right? We are discussing the overall implications, particularly from a Western bubble perspective, on this topic.
Yeah, and it wouldn't be particularly interesting for people to listen to us parsing one particular judgment, right? One particular verdict, especially about the United States, but to be honest, about any other country either. We are not legal scholars. That's not what we're here to do. We do comment, and we can comment on broad tendencies, political tendencies, and the Supreme Court has actually become a political piñata. It has become part of politics in ways that is extremely unhealthy for the operations of US democracy, especially because if you think about the crown jewel of the US Constitution, of the way that the US political system has been set up, it's the crown jewel is the separation of powers. It's the three independent branches of government, the executive, the legislative, and the judicial. So the executive is the White House, the legislative is Congress, and the judicial is the Supreme Court, and then the other branches of the legal structures. They are supposed to exist independently from each other in order to keep each other honest. And that is collapsing in front of our eyes. We see that the Supreme Court has just become part of the political infighting between conservatives and liberals, and that would make the founding fathers turn in their graves, no doubt.
I mean, this has to a certain extent always been the case, right? Particularly with the nomination process. So a Democratic president would select a candidate that's maybe more right on the Democratic side of the spectrum, and then a Republican president will maybe select a more Republican-minded candidate. So this has always been the case. And usually we've seen as kind of hold the balance, right? There's 9 judges. They would usually be 4 Democrats, 4 Republicans, and then the one in the middle, you know, depending on the year, right? One side would have basically one up on the other, because these judges, they are basically on tenure for their entire lives, right? Once you're appointed, you either step back, okay, or you get removed, or you simply pass away, and then your position will be filled again.
Yeah, so the idea that there is some politics involved is obvious. There are political appointees. Congress, in the end, votes for... So the executive, the White House, nominates a potential justice, and then they have to go through hearings, and then they go through Congress, and they get confirmed. That is not in question. There is a political element to the appointment of justices, but the idea has always been that the moment that they then are appointed, then they leave their kind of tribal political identity outside. They might still be conservative or liberally inclined. That's part of their personality. That's why they were voted in by Democrats or Republicans or by some kind of consensus. But they do not behave according to political fractured society. They behave based on legal precedent. They try to perform their duty as the judicial branch in a very important balance of powers between the three branches. So that has always been the core understanding of the Supreme Court. And that's why the Supreme Court has always been a deeply respected institution, because they do not scoop to the infighting that you see on Capitol Hill. They do not become part of that ugly kind of Republican versus Democrat dynamic. They stay above that. They stay above the fray, traditionally, until recently.
But and even because now recently we've seen the Supreme Court divided in a 6-3, right? So there's 6 more Republican judges and 3 more Democratic judges. But we wouldn't even want a 4-4 plus a tiebreaker, right? Because as you said, we want 9 judges up there who, with each decision, think about, okay, from my interpretation of the law, what is the correct decision here? So ideally, you would want, right, on one decision to vote, I mean, 5 of the judges together, and then on another decision, maybe 8 of them together, because they all kind of are excellent legal scholars and have a profound understanding of the law.
And of course, they cannot completely separate their own convictions, their own ideology from their rulings, in the sense that if you are conservative, then you have a specific worldview and you're more inclined to vote in a certain direction if there is ambiguity. But you will not consciously try to push for a conservative narrative. So the issue is, how do you perceive your role? What is it that your duty is within that job? And the fact that Republicans want to appoint conservatives and Democrats want to appoint liberals, that's clear, because if you have a liberal, they will be more inclined to protect, I don't know, civil rights. If you have a conservative, they will be more inclined to protect religious rights or something like that. That has always been an established truth, and that has not been particularly controversial. But even if you have a conservative or liberal inclination, you were supposed to still primarily try to do your best within your personality, within your identity, your best in terms of legality, in terms of legal judgment as a Supreme Court justice, rather than part of a political movement. And yet everything now in the 21st century has become political. Everyone is fighting the other side. And unfortunately, the Supreme Court seems to have now also fallen into that trap.
We had a conversation in the lead up to this episode about the fact that if you are from one tribe, right, you've been appointed by your tribe to serve for the Supreme Court or to serve in an important position in Parliament, maybe as the Parliament's president, or aka the majority speaker, right, to stay within the US lingo, then you should be more inclined to basically be very strict on your own party, right? To keep them in check, to keep them in balance. And that's something that we have observed in our own home countries, right? So in the Netherlands and in Germany. Here in Germany, it's the case that basically each party that is part of parliament gets to basically send one president of the parliament or vice president, and then they collectively make sure that the role of the parliament is strengthened, that the government, the executive, is not basically overreaching or overstepping parliament. And it's always a little bit nice to see, right, that someone from the same party is being very tough on their own prime minister, which then in turn leads to high approval ratings of these positions. I know that the presidency of the parliament in Germany is very much respected, just like our Supreme Court, right, with more or less approval ratings of 80%. That's very much compared to what we just saw in the United States with 40%. And it feels like the United States has kind of lost this element, right, of being very tough on your own party.
Yes, because the United States are now the front runners in this, if you like, this culture war situation, right? This clashes between left versus right, liberal versus conservative. And this is also slightly visible in Europe, but not as much yet. So you have these significant conversations in Europe still happening because it's your average European still doesn't walk around feeling that they have to fight the other side more than simply fight for the well-being of their country. And this conversation in the Netherlands is a long-standing conversation that has received new poignancy, if you like, lately, because the current government, or the government that is now going to be installed this month in July, is a government where four parties make up the government. That's very much in line with Dutch tradition, coalition government. There's nothing new there. But what is new about it is that none of the leaders of the four parties is actually going to be prime minister. The prime minister is going to be a neutral figure who actually traditionally comes from a fifth party. And so now you have a government led by a prime minister who is dependent on the support of four parties in parliament, with those four parties at least theoretically, critically holding the government to account. Now, I have my doubts about whether that will happen, but that is in line with a long-standing conversation in the Netherlands about what's called duality, that even if your party makes up the government, you as a parliamentarian still needs to critically assess that government. And you cannot make deals with that government simply because they're from your same party. You're a parliament, you're there to make sure that your government stays honest. The government needs to convince you as a parliamentarian that they're doing the right thing. And you don't automatically vote for them simply because they come from the same party as you. That, at least that conversation, even though in practice it almost never works like that, that conversation is a valuable conversation to have.
And this is a conversation that's no longer happening in the United States for the sense. And when we try to track down or pin down the moment when the Supreme Court has basically become politicized, right before you can still argue, okay, some of the usual due processes were kind of right overstepped, overlooked. But then we could see that basically all of these appointments or appointees of Donald Trump, right, three of them being there, led to one moment in 2022. And so we've actually discussed this in our podcast in 2022, right? It was one of our first episodes when we kind of used the overturning of Roe against Wade to have a deeper and longer discussion about the hollowing out of institutions within the West. And this is also, again, just to say that we're not legal scholars, how we're looking at this, right? Is that the Supreme Court becoming politicized, of one side clearly dominating it and using it for its own purposes, right? Overturning Roe against Wade for, you know, privacy concerns, right? To basically ban abortions throughout the country and officially, right, giving it back to the states, but effectively using the overturning of a case to politicize the Supreme Court.
Yeah, so in isolation, we would never be speaking about Roe v. Wade. It would not be an issue that is up to us, because in isolation, you could make theoretically the case, and that's kind of the case that the Supreme Court majority tried to make, that it was a matter of simply state rights versus federal rights. It should be up to states who decide this kind of thing. It's not a federal issue. Whether that is true or not is not up to you and me. We are not the right people to make that decision, that to judge the validity of that claim. But Roe v. Wade abortion has been for a very long time, certainly since Roe v. Wade, has been the third rail of American politics. It's been the thing that is basically almost defines the identity of both sides, right? One side arguing that the other side are baby killers, basically every year are responsible for the death of millions of lives through abortion, and the other side arguing that they are defending women's rights and the right to choose, and that a overbearing state determining that is basically infringes upon what individualism and democracy should be about. So you've got this enormously important clash, and here comes in the Supreme Court that could have absolutely decided not to deal with this case. The Supreme Court has significant leeway in deciding which cases it takes up and which cases it doesn't. So it would have made sense, especially in a time that is already so polarized with the culture wars, with the so much anger and so much frustration from one side to the other side in American politics. It would have made enormous sense for the Supreme Court to say, we're not going to touch this because we don't want to become part of this political tension. This is not up to us. There might be an interesting legal question here, and it might be that Roe v. Wade is unconstitutional, or that there's a problem there, that the decision that was made 50 years ago was the wrong decision. But we cannot afford to become part of this political this political battlefield, of this political war that is being waged. And by taking it up, whatever we decide, we would actually become a political piñata. Yet they did decide to pick it up. They did decide to basically touch this. And then they decide to overturn precedent. So then they say, hey, look, we are conservative judges. Everyone knows we're conservative judges. And lo and behold, we're now going to go with the political conservative side. We're going to make a decision in line with our tribe versus the other tribe. And by doing so, in 2022, the Supreme Court basically signaled, we don't care about the Supreme Court flying above mundane politics. We are going to get into this. We are going to get into the culture wars, and we're going to take a position firmly on the side of conservatism, on the side, if you like, of Republicans against liberals. And the moment they did that is the moment that the floodgates basically opened to making the Supreme Court just another political tool without any kind of broader respect from the population. And you see the approval ratings plummet as a result.
Exactly. They're plummeting, right? Because, I mean, before you could say that, okay, 60, right? I mean, high 60 percentages. So that kind of shows you that both sides are more or less happy with it, right? It's not exactly 51%, right? That whoever is in the majority right now is happy with it. No, it's actually that both sides are happy with it. I'm sure that now the Supreme Court has lost at least the Democratic side to a large extent. And I think today's decision, the one on Donald Trump, right? And to what extent he can actually be held accountable for his actions in office, is not helping the Supreme Court in kind of regaining trust and legitimacy.
No, so again, the same argument works here. If it was just in isolation, this one specific judgment, it wouldn't be up to us. But given that this is part of a week of all kinds of judgments, which we will discuss in a second, and this comes after the Roe v. Wade and 2 years of the Supreme Court basically signaling, hey, we are willing to be part of these culture wars, we are willing to become part of the political debate, then it becomes very ugly, because lo and behold, every time there's an important judgment, the Supreme Court votes conservative. And these are not legally objective rulings, right? This is not, but the Supreme Court doesn't exist like for to be a robot, to be a computer, to just come out with an objective answer. The Supreme Court exists because there are many ambiguities in law that don't have a clearly objective right or wrong answer, and the Supreme Court has to make sense of that, especially make sense based on long-standing precedent, based on tradition, basically being an anchor of stability and of legal jurisprudence in a world full of political infighting. And instead of being that anchor, instead of trying to be a voice of sort of traditional reason, they are now saying, we are conservative, we're not afraid to hide it, and every time that there is a judgment to be made that is of import to the American population, we will go with the conservative interpretation of things. And that is incredibly scary. And then you notice that it very often, not always, but very often, goes exactly along party lines. The three liberal judges, at least appointed by liberal presidents, they vote against the majority, and the majority consists of the six conservative judges, the ones who were elected by Republican presidents. And that is not how it's supposed to work. That is not how the Founding Fathers set up the system.
Because the way the Founding Fathers did set up the system is with checks and balances. And that's one of the main issues with today's ruling, right? Because with the ruling today, that's saying that, okay, Donald Trump cannot be held accountable for decisions or actions he made that are kind of officially within the presidency. He can only be semi be held accountable for non-official actions. You are basically kind of giving the US president, the executive, almost a blank check, right, to do whatever they want to do. And that's not within the spirit of checks and balances.
That's exactly it. So if you have checks and balances, you've got the independent branches of government that are supposed to keep each other honest, then the last thing you want is for one branch, the judicial branch, to tell the executive branch, basically do whatever you like. That is not how a properly functioning political system works, at least not in a democratic system. I mean, if you're an authoritarian system, then it becomes a whole different conversation. But within a supposedly democratic system, you cannot have one branch that is literally immune by today's judgment, immune from prosecution as long as it's an official act. Trump or any other president, Biden or anyone in the future, can essentially break the law as much as they like, as long as it's an official act. And then that moment, the Supreme Court says, well, this is not up to us. We are not here to interfere with the other branch of government. Well, they are supposed to interfere with the other branch of government. They're supposed to keep the other branch of government honest. That's why they exist in the first place.
Something that we've mentioned in the past is, right, we're not taking any sides here, with or left, right side of the spectrum, right? The reason why we're criticizing the Republican side in today's episode is simply because they are the ones doing it right now. However, one of the big worries is, yes, I mean, Donald Trump can now basically do what he wants in case he gets reelected. However, Donald Trump is, right, we've called him a clown before, and I think we can do that, right? He's not necessarily intellectual, an ideologue who actually has an agenda to dismantle the government for his ideological reasons. It's very much for personal reasons, for personal gain, but not for those. A big problem here with today's ruling is that no matter which side, if there is or happens to be a really intelligent person with a very clear ideology who has an interest in dismantling the government and maybe establishing more authoritarian ways of governing, then they are absolutely able to do so right now. And there's fewer checks and balances on this than before. And this could be from either side, right? This could be an extreme Democrat or an extreme Republican, if you want to call him that.
And this is exactly the criticism at the end of the first term of the Obama administration that existed. So even though I think it's fair to say that we as Europeans would be probably politically more aligned with the Democratic Party than the Republican Party, not on everything maybe, but in general, Europeans, you know, from a European perspective, the Democrats would be right of center and the Republicans would be really, really extreme right. So in that sense, I think intuitively we would probably side with the Democrats. The whole point is that it's not about tribalism, and we care about the institutions more than political intuition, right? So even if the Democrats seem to be policy-wise a little bit more reasonable from my perspective than the Republicans, it doesn't matter, because what we care about is that institutions function well and that foundation of a democratic liberal society, liberal in the sense of small l, like liberal in sense of protecting individual freedoms and those kinds of things, not liberal in the political sense. A liberal democratic society requires the institutions to be honest, requires institutions to fulfill their function. And the Obama administration was rightfully, also by me and by many others, on both sides of the political spectrum, very heavily criticized for continuing the hollowing out of the institutions after 9/11, after the war on terror. Obama very kind of had implicitly promised that, for example, he would repeal the Patriot Act, that he would close Guantanamo Bay, that he would do all kinds of things that were deemed unconstitutional and certainly, if you like, un-American during the George W. Bush years. He comes into power and he thinks, hey, actually, that's kind of nice to have these powers available to me that were granted to me by the Bush administration. I'm going to continue this because why would I actually make my own life more difficult? And as a result, people like me really started disliking Barack Obama for exactly that, for not understanding that he had a duty above politics. And by doing so, he basically laid a foundation that can very easily be abused. You rightfully say that Trump doesn't have the ideology nor the, if you like, the intellect to actually make use of it. He doesn't want to create a dictatorship in the United States. He just wants to push his own agenda. He wants to go down as the greatest president in American history. He won't, but that's what he wants. And he wants to, make sure that his business does well, that he profits from it, those kinds of things. He doesn't have an image of some kind of fascist dictatorship. However, a more intelligent Trump character, a more ideologically inclined Trump character, would actually be able to use the decisions by George W. Bush, the decisions by Obama, and now the decisions by the Supreme Court to actually fundamentally alter the political makeup of the United States.
Mm. One of the other cases that has been decided upon by the Supreme Court in recent weeks was basically this case on how the people, the individuals involved in the storming of the Capitol on January 6th of 2021, how they should or could be trialed, right? So there was this case that federal prosecutors overreached when they used an obstruction law to charge hundreds of these rioters. And the Supreme Court ruled on it in a favorable way, basically towards the rioters, particularly in a case that could also infect, right, Donald Trump. And here we again have that negative or that bad aftertaste that Donald Trump himself appointed three of the Supreme Court justices, right? So there's yet another case that kind of gives you this bad feeling. As you said before, if this was a standalone case and there wasn't this pattern that we are observing for a few years now, then, you know, maybe these justices are right. Maybe they have a good point here. But given that this is one of many examples, I'm becoming increasingly concerned for the United States.
It's deeply, deeply concerning. And if it is concerning for the United States and the sustainability or unsustainability of their political system, it is concerning for every European as well, because we as Europeans have always kind of followed the American lead. The United States was supposed to be the experiment that would guide us all towards a better tomorrow, right? And the fact that the United States is crashing this blatantly, this rapidly, into a completely different political system where the founding fathers no longer have any relevance, apparently, because it's all about two tribes trying to murder each other. That means that the rest of the democratic world should be shaking in their boots. It's not at all clear that democracy can survive this onslaught of tribalism, of populism, of basically us versus them kind of thinking, right? And it's hugely concerning, and it's way more concerning than the actual politics that is at play, right? It doesn't really matter. It matters a little bit because it has an impact in the short term on people, but in the long term, it doesn't really matter whether the Supreme Court is on the liberal side or the conservative side. What matters is that they are on a political side. That is what's wrong with all of this.
And another aspect of this, right? So we've looked at the difficulties with checks and balances. We've looked at the difficulties of the Supreme Court basically choosing a side, right? All of these factors lead to the public losing further trust. So now in recent week, there has been yet another case that leads to another point of concern. And that was this Chevron case, right? Where now, before we were concerned that the Supreme Court kind of strengthened the role of the president, right, by making them immune. We were concerned that they were politicized and so on and so forth. However, now the Supreme Court in this case ruled in a way that also strengthens its own role in the system, right? So by basically taking away power from different agencies within the government, the Supreme Court is strengthening its own rule. However, Boulder, I mean, I have a tough time kind of really explaining the technicalities of this. So how does a ruling by the Supreme Court on a Chevron case basically take away power from agencies?
Yeah, so this is based on a long-standing tradition where essentially the Supreme Court has said there are loads of specific cases where federal agencies have a difficult, ambiguous decision to make that doesn't clearly violate the Constitution, doesn't clearly violate objectively some laws, but they need to make decisions on, for example, the EPA needs to make decisions on the environment, or the IRS needs to make decisions on taxation. And those decisions are complex, require a lot of expertise, require a lot of knowledge about minutiae. That is not what we as the judicial branch exist for, in the sense that these are political, ambiguous choices. We as the Supreme Court are not going to interfere with those, as long as the Constitution isn't violated or anything very obvious. We are not going to interfere with those. We're going to defer to the judgment of the federal agency. So the EPA will be given broad leeway in their decision making when it comes to protecting the environment, for example. And that makes a lot of sense because, again, the judicial branch is not there for policymaking. And if there is a lot of ambiguity, then the law doesn't really have a clear voice. Then it is more about what you emphasize, what you politically care about. And that should be deferred to by the Supreme Court to those agencies. That is a very sensible position to take, saying we're not all the time going to micromanage things that really are political subjective decisions. And now, with the current case, the Supreme Court has said, we're going to reverse that. We're going to reverse precedent. We are going to actually break with this tradition. And we're going to say, no, 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 it should be up to us to interfere with federal agencies. Basically taking away the freedom of agencies and experts to make informed, but ultimately ambiguous choices.
And that's, I mean, well, micromanaging is one of those terms I think that everyone has a bad memory with or bad feelings about, but that's exactly it, right? So now you have courts that need to make these decisions for these agencies because, well, maybe these agencies are overstepping, you know, their power. Maybe that's a legitimate question. However, as you said, by the courts taking over this, we have now lawyers dealing with it. And just as we said in this episode, hello, we are not legal experts. We're not going to argue with the law here. But the court should be doing the same, right? By saying that, hello, we are not environmental experts. We don't know whether this, was a violation of this and whether this should be fined in a certain way. I mean, now the court is basically taking away expertise from cases and adding power to their own pockets.
Exactly. The only thing they should be doing is checking if it blatantly, objectively violates the law. That's it. And if it doesn't, then, you know, they should back away from this. Now, of course, again, here the context matters, right? This is the context of a conservative part of the country, the base of, if you like, the Supreme Court justices that are seen as conservative, that have been elected to the Supreme Court by the Republican Party, a conservative segment of the US population that believes that the government should be limited in every way possible because the government essentially, government agencies, federal agencies especially, are essentially a liberal bulwark, are there to basically take away the rights of conservative America to live their lives. And so the context is not simply one of the Supreme Court taking on more power, which it is. They are basically giving themselves increased power, but they're also giving themselves increased power to limit the power of government agencies because they believe that those government agencies are on the other side of the political spectrum, form part of the other tribe, of the liberals, of the Democrats, not of their values. And once again, it is therefore a decision that has nothing to do with the law, very little to do with the law, and it's mostly inspired by this culture war dynamic.
I mean, I might be repeating myself here a little bit, right? But we're talking about all these different cases, and each of these cases basically has a different impact on the institutions within the United States, right? So we already talked about the president basically being a king now, not being accountable. We just talked about courts taking power back and taking expertise away from rulings. We've talked about, a court that has been heavily influenced by Donald Trump, making rulings in favor of Donald Trump. The problem is we're not done yet. So there's another case, also from the last few weeks. It's a little bit concerning. And this was the Snyder versus the United States case, right? A case in which the Supreme Court basically ruled on different forms of bribery. And it said that in this case that they ruled that gratuities, right? So post facto gifts and payments are technically not bribes, because bribes, per definition, happen only before a desired official act, right? So saying that, if you receive money or gifts or other pleasantries before you make a decision as a politician or as a judge, right, then that's a bribe. That's very clear. But if you receive that present afterwards, then you didn't receive that for the decision, right? So that's not considered a bribe, at least not for us.
In some ways, this is the most insane ruling, right? This is the most insane, because you don't have to be a lawyer to understand the insanity of this. So essentially, it means that if I want to build a factory and you are a lawmaker and you have to weigh my desire to build a factory with environmental concerns or with local concerns that it might pollute the air of housing or something like that, I basically informally say to you, hey, please, grant me permission to build my factory and, we'll be good friends. And as long as I then just wait 2 days until you've made your ruling, and after that ruling, I give you $1 million, it's fine. It's not corruption anymore. The Supreme Court has said, just make sure that you wait 1 or 2 days until after it's been done, and then it's all good. But that is, of course, complete insanity. And there is a very dark context here, because this is within the context of now months of discussion about the actual ethical standards of the Supreme Court itself, the potential corruption that exists within the Supreme Court that has been very deeply discussed. So it's basically the Supreme Court giving themselves a way out from any corruption charges. It should be noted that in principle, Supreme Court justices are free from persecution anyway, because they're immune, because they're Supreme Court justices. But basically they're saying, hey, you know what? If anyone accuses us of corruption, we've now essentially legislated that it isn't corruption, because we didn't get anything before any ruling. We just get once in a while presents after rulings, or completely independent from rulings.
And again, this ruling was along party lines, right? So it was 6-3, and it was the usual six suspects against the other usual suspects, which is even more concerning if we look at the individual behavior of some of these justices, right? And we are now going to look at two of them. So on the one side, we have Justice Clarence Thomas, and on the other side, we have Justice Alito. And both of them have been doing, I don't know if you can say shady things, but maybe within the context of Supreme Court justices, you should say shady things. And particularly in the context of this ruling, if we look at Clarence Thomas, because he has been receiving a lot of presents and a lot of very nice gifts worth millions in the last 30 years. You could never really say, well, which one belongs to which case, but it's a bit concerning that a Supreme Court justice has some billionaire friends who regularly give them gifts, and then they receive rulings that are coincidentally in their favor.
Yeah, so Clarence Thomas is the longest sitting justice, all the way back to the Reagan administration this comes from. And he has been, over the past 40 years, clearly become part of sort of this right-wing millionaire establishment, right, where he has very good friends who are very rich, who have a lot of political interest, and he has actually resided as a Supreme Court justice over cases that affected his friends. So these friends have given him gifts when it comes to holidays, use of homes, direct gifts, and he has then passed judgment on cases that affected directly those specific friends. Now, in any reasonable practical perspective, from any reasonable definition, this is corruption. Even if, in his own mind, Justice Thomas didn't rule because he got presents, the moment you've got friends who give you presents, you can't independently from that make rulings that affect those friends. It's just not part of our human psychology. There's no human so rational that they can completely separate one from the other. So instead of recusing himself during all those cases, he didn't. Now it comes out actually how much he received from his friends, how close he is to some of those people. And any reasonable person would actually say, this cannot be. This is completely unethical. And yet they've just, after this whole debate, after this whole discussion, they pass a law to basically say to the world, well, sorry, we just legislate. We're Supreme Court, but we're legislating now. We're not just ruling. We're creating essentially laws that define corruption, bribery as something that can only happen directly before the fact of corruption. Afterwards, it doesn't matter anymore. So it's very, very concerning. It is basically a Supreme Court that is running amok, and something that, you know, raises very serious questions about the health or the lack of health of the American system.
So our listeners know that I sometimes like to take things out of one context and put them into another context because it helps to give perspective. If this was the behavior of a court in a country receiving development aid from the West, I am pretty sure the West would start wagging its finger and say, hey, listen, one second, hold up. This, your Supreme Court is corrupt. We can no longer send you billions of dollars in aid as long as this behavior is happening.
No doubt. And the same could, by the way, be said about many of those other rulings that we've just discussed, right? A Supreme Court that says our president is immune from prosecution. Well, yeah, okay, so you're now living in a dictatorship. That's how the American press would cover it. That's how the White House would cover it. Like, no, we can't give you development aid if you start becoming this undemocratic. This goes against the rule of law. This goes against good governance. But somehow, because it happens in the United States, we're still stuck with this idea that these are minor little steps that don't really matter. That you know, the system is strong enough to survive. Well, the system is surviving, but increasingly it's hanging on by a thread. It's increasingly being undermined by these kinds of horrific decisions. Now, I should point out, though, that the answer to, for example, this bribery and corruption situation is not completely obvious, because the Democrats for the past couple of months have been jumping up and down about this, understandably so, it's worrying, but they've been trying to push for legislation to limit the Supreme Court. The moment that happens is now you've got a fight between two branches of government in a way that is not particularly healthy. Rather than respecting each other's independence, now a democratically run Congress wants to limit the ability for the Supreme Court to actually stay independent. So the Founding Fathers didn't cater to for this. They didn't create mechanisms that would allow this to be resolved in a productive way. It's the system is collapsing, and it's almost as every time that someone tries to do something about it, it's making it worse. Democrats trying to interfere with the Supreme Court is in many ways making the whole situation worse, because it further undermines the independence of institutions.
Absolutely. Just to finish this a little bit on Clarence Thomas, because I find this outrageous, right? Because when they say, oh, he has accepted vacations and private jet flights and they were worth millions, this man, basically since becoming a justice, has accepted over 30 destination vacations and 20 private jet flights. That's incredible. I mean, I'm not gonna lie, I mean, that sounds like a really lucrative position. I might become a US Supreme Court justice, because it sounds very nice.
And that already is concerning. But then if you realize that this is from people who were directly affected by his rulings, I mean, it just becomes absolutely astounding. And it is from one of the justices who is most known for his hardcore conservative views, who is very much part of one clear group of politicians and business leaders who have a very specific, if you like, non-universal vision of what the country should be like.
I mean, just to mention some of his best friends, we're talking about the Koch brothers or Harlan Crow, right? So those are GOP mega donors. And
these are not politically neutral. These are people who are pumping millions and millions into the Trump campaign, into right-wing causes, into repealing Roe v. Wade, into all those kinds of things, right? So this is a very incestuous kind of situation.
We've already mentioned the culture wars in the United States, and one of the other justices, Alito, he has very intensive thoughts on this, right? So there was this situation where, I mean, we should say that here he was secretly recorded and he actually thought he was speaking to a like-minded person, right, to a Republican, a fellow Republican, but it was in fact someone from the other side. And there he was caught in a conversation saying, and I quote, "One side or the other side is going to win. I mean, there can be a way of working, a way of living together peacefully, but it's difficult, you know, because there are differences on fundamental things that really can't be compromised. It's not like you can split the difference," end quote.
Yes, and this is astounding from one of the nine people in the country that should be the least tribal of all of them, right? So a Supreme Court justice should be above all of this petty political squabbling, and instead he is saying, no, my side, our side, is fighting this other side, this enemy. One of them is going to win. We better make sure it's our side that's going to win, and thereby essentially signaling, I, as a Supreme Court justice, will do everything to make my side win. Now, if you then take that in the context of the rulings that Alito has voted for, when it comes to Roe v. Wade, when it comes to Trump, when it comes to Chevron, when it comes to bribery, now our interpretation of those rulings surely have to take this into account. This is a political zealot who uses his position within a supposedly non-political institution to basically defend his tribe against the enemy.
What's the international relations context?
A few days ago, you taught me an interesting saying that I didn't know about US politics, basically saying that politics stops at the water edge. And you referred to the water edge being the two sides of the oceans, right? So the Pacific and the Atlantic. What exactly did you mean with this, and why is it relevant to international relations?
Well, this is a longstanding saying in the United States that, you know, for the 20th century was completely respected, or at least broadly respected. I should never say completely about anything. But it was broadly respected within American politics that how the Founding Fathers set up the system was, you've got Congress responsible for domestic policymaking. And therefore, at a domestic level, there can be lots of infighting, lots of arguing, lots of disagreements about what should happen to income taxes, what should happen to housing, what should happen to education, to healthcare. It's perfectly fine to have this political fight in domestic politics. But when it comes to foreign policy, when it comes to the outside world, the United States stands together. We're all in this as an American people. We are all interested in making our country do well on the international stage. We have our supreme ambassador, if you like, called president, the resident of the White House, who is responsible for representing us on the international stage. And so when our president or when our institutions do that, when they represent the United States on the international stage in foreign policy making, we should end our politics. It's no longer about left versus right. It's just about America versus the rest of the world. So, you know, kind of disrespectful towards Canada and Mexico because they are also foreign policy. But when you say politics stops at the water edge, that means that the moment you go away from the East Coast towards Europe or away from the West Coast towards Asia, at that moment, we should no longer be tribal, because then it is just about the well-being of our country. And that goes above and beyond any differences that could exist between Democrats and Republicans.
And that's no longer the case when we're talking about foreign policy.
Completely disappeared. And you know, the role of the president on the global stage. Look at how the Republican conservative side of the country covered Joe Biden representing the United States during the D-Day celebrations only 2 weeks ago. or at a celebration's anniversary, whenever Joe Biden does something when it comes to China or when it comes to Ukraine, straight away conservative America jumps on that. So there's no longer this belief that representing the United States abroad is something that can unite the country. No, it's just a continuation of the tribal politics that exist domestically. And once again, that's a sign of how the times have changed, how the country no longer sees itself as a unified whole, how the country no longer believes that they're all in this together when it comes to being American and when it comes to American institutions and proud of the country that the founding fathers envisioned. And instead, it is just about beating the other side. It's just about defeating those who do not agree with you.
And I feel like you can apply this same logic to the Supreme Court as well, right? Where at least to me, it seems like that 20, 30 years ago, yes, it was always nice to maybe have five judges on your side versus four. But now it more seems like it's about winning, right? It's about winning the Supreme Court, something that's a bit concerning.
And there's an interesting kind of self-fulfilling dynamic, vicious circle, if you like, or self-fulfilling prophecy, if that's the right word. Namely that because this has now been accepted, that everything is tribal, foreign policy is tribal, the Supreme Court is tribal, everything is about this culture war. You will no longer have legal minds, scholars, justices who try to be neutral, who try to take their job seriously from a foundational perspective, who say, hey, you know, yeah, I might lean a little bit conservative or I might lean a little bit liberal, but that doesn't matter. As a judge, I have a responsibility towards the country. As a diplomat, I have a responsibility towards the country. That no longer happens because that is no longer the road to success. If you want to get a promotion, if you want to get to the Supreme Court eventually, you don't want to be seen as a neutral defender of the well-being of your country. You need to be seen as part of one of the two tribes because that's the only way that one of those two tribes will support you in becoming a Supreme Court justice. That's the only way that one of those tribes will support you to become an ambassador, to become a civil servant, a high-ranking civil servant within the State Department or anything like that, right? So you now have an entire generation of young, up-and-coming, undoubtedly intelligent people who are being told they receive signals that their way to become influential, their way to become successful and to do their job properly, in air quotes, is to actually choose one of the two sides. And as such, it becomes a horrible vicious circle that it's very difficult to see how the country can get out of that anymore. Because if all those people no longer learn that there is something that goes above politics, that goes higher than politics, then democracy is doomed. Democracy doesn't have a future like that.
And can you explain to our listeners what is the problem?
What a nice transition to what's the damage, right? Because I mean, if you end with democracy doesn't have a future, I think that's a very nice headline for all the different problems and damages that we've discussed throughout this episode already, right? Is that the US president is now basically as untouchable as a king. A bribery is now essentially legal, right? The courts are taking power away from the agencies, and with this also taking expertise away from different rulings. I mean, we're looking at a whole set of institutions that we really like, that we really enjoy, being completely hollowed out.
Yeah, and this is one of the issues that I think people don't always realize sufficiently. I say arrogantly as if I understand everything, but there is this habit of, for example, teaching our children, certainly in the United States, this habit of teaching children about the institutions. Like here you've got the three branches of government. Here, this is the way you get a bill passed through Congress. Every 4 years, you get to vote for your senator, or for your senator, for the president, every 2 years for your Congress representative, etc., etc. And yes, of course, that is part of it, but it is much more important how people perceive the responsibility of those systems. Having the systems themselves is not enough. If those institutions are hollowed out, their existence becomes meaningless. If the Supreme Court becomes a political piñata, it is no longer a sign of a well-functioning democracy. If you vote every 4 years, it doesn't matter if those if the results of that vote actually are meaningless. So we psychologically try to cling on to the fact to the idea that we can still admire the visible institutions as they exist and as they have existed for the past 250 years. But if you look a little bit further, democracy and a liberal society do not purely depend on the existence of these institutions, but also on the way that those institutions operate. And those operations have been decaying at an accelerated pace for the past decades. And it becomes harder and harder to speak of a vibrant democracy like this.
And what now?
And with this, we basically already have the future, right? It becomes very difficult to speak of a democracy if we continue this. I mean, as we said just a few minutes ago, if this was happening in another country, U.S. media would basically use the term democratic backsliding, this is almost authoritarian, and so on and so forth. And I mean, the quick fix here is obviously, well, don't do it. Right? I mean, don't try to further undermine the system. Don't try to further politicize all these processes.
Yeah, and the problem there with saying don't do it is that at the core of all of this is a deeply ingrained psychology among Western populations, certainly the US population, that they are in this culture war, right? That they are fighting the other side. So then the short-term victories, battles that you can win in the short term, seem more important than the long-term future that you're looking at. And it always amazes me that those people who are happy that Trump now is going to get off, probably, it's going to be much easier for Donald Trump to not be prosecuted for his actions. That means that next time there's a Democratic president in office, a new Barack Obama, that will be the same for Barack Obama, right? I mean, for that new Barack Obama, there will be a new set of presidents in the future now who have enormous powers. And those people who are celebrating Trump's freedom right now will bemoan the fact that the Democratic president will also have those powers and that freedom and can do dodgy things. So the future is one in which this tribalism is likely to continue and accelerate without either one of the tribes actually pulling back and say, hang on, can we stop thinking tribally for 1 second? Can we stop thinking about the short-term battles about policy? And can we think about the long-term institutions and the health of our society? Because when the Democrats are in power, they're not going to put pressure on their president to actually reverse some of these positions, right? Because it's going to be practically very useful, just as it was practically very useful for Barack Obama to inherit the George W. Bush legacy from the war on terror. And so the future in that sense is very bleak. And the only thing that can probably change it is some kind of radical event that changes the mindset and the psychology of these culture wars that we've been discussing.
This seems like a great moment to end today's conversation on the United States Supreme Court. If you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake that we've made throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com. We will try to incorporate them in our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure you join us again next week when we burst the Western Bubble. That is it from my side. Balder, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
Well, I believe that we're already recording quite a long episode, if I'm correct. And to make things worse, I've got quite a long quote, but I guess that's consistent with the content from the previous hour. This is a quote from James Madison, of course, one of the most influential founding fathers. And probably one of his most famous publications is Federalist Paper 51, which was written in the decade after the independence of the United States. And it very much describes the importance of the separation of powers and the role of each branch of government. And when he refers to departments in this quote, he basically refers to the institution of the Supreme Court versus the other two branches of government. And the quote goes, "It is equally evident that the members of each department should be as little dependent as possible on those of the others for the emoluments annexed to their offices. Were the executive magistrate or the judges not independent of the legislature in this particular, their independence in every other would be merely nominal. But the great security against the gradual concentration of the several powers in the same department consists in giving to those who administer each department the necessary constitutional means and personal motives to resist encroachments of the others."